Tax Conference Committee to order. Sorry, we were waiting for something to be copied. And I guess it was here a few minutes, and I didn't see it, so I apologize for that. And I am not, I guess I'm going to ask Ms. Bergman. I thought there was a four-page document we were getting copied. I have a one-page. Okay, members. What we want to talk about is we want to talk about all the targeted business tax reductions and all the various proposals. Okay, so there's one.
They're
each.
Separate.
Okay. And so I think if we can just start by passing out what the House is doing. And I think we'll need some assistance here. What's your page's name?
Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. Thanks. Let me just... Okay, this is the House's. So we want to look at what the House is doing as far as doing things for businesses in the tax bill. And so after that's passed out by Charlie, then maybe if there's extras, they can just be put on the table for anyone who wants them. But so, Senator and members, if you look at business tax reductions in the House bill, which is on this one sheeter, you can see that the House is spending $97 million in the first biennium and $43 million in the second biennium and $800 million outside the window of the two bienniums that we plan for. $800,000. Okay, so $97 million in the first biennium, $43 million in the second biennium, $800,000 after that. And then if someone can help Charlie, because we have four different sheets here that we want to go through. This is the Senate coming next here. Senator. Okay, so now I want to look at, do all the senators have the Senate now in front of them? Okay, so in the Senate tax bill, if you look the first biennium, the Senate is spending $434 million. And I'm sorry we don't have this all on one sheet. I wish we did. The Senate is spending $434 million in targeted business tax incentives, $234 million in the next biennium, and $287 million outside the budget window. So, I mean, I think members can guess where I'm going with this. I mean, if you look at the House, we're at 97 in the first biennium, and the Senate's at $434 million in the second, in the first biennium. And, you know, the House just is not interested in spending this kind of money in targeted tax incentives for businesses. Now, I know people will characterize this as job creators, but people should know that, you know, it's being paid for by, in the Senate tax bill, by raising taxes on businesses. So the tax increase on businesses in the Senate bill is, I think we can find that, but I think it's on the spreadsheet about $475 million. So in my estimation, it's like you're raising taxes on all businesses to give things to some businesses. So, you know, I just have not been a fan of these items. I don't think they work. And there's, you know, division in the House on Democrats and Republicans. Some people love these things, but you can see on the House sheet, you know, I'm phasing in single sales, which is a one-time thing. It takes a couple bienniums to get there. Section 179 expensing conformity takes a while to get there. And then the only really ongoing forever thing I'm paying for is an R&D credit versus the Senate's at the 434 number. And even 6 years out, there's still a $287 million commitment for these tax programs. So now, if I may, I'd like to talk about the governor's proposal. And everyone should have that. Does everyone have the governor? So the governor is spending in the first biennium $251 million, so more than the House but less than the Senate. The governor is spending $424 million, more than the House and more than the Senate in the second biennium. These are spending. People like to call them tax cuts, but they're spending. And then the outside the window, the governor's committing the state in his proposal to another ongoing $671 million in new tax preferential treatments for businesses in spending. I mean, to me, that's just growing the deficit in the out window another $670 million. And we can just have a disagreement about that. Because some people like to call this jobs and other people like to call them spending. I mean, on the spreadsheets, the fact of the matter is to meet the like the governor's number in the out years, you're going to have to raise taxes another $671 million to pay for that. Or you're going to have to cut something another $671 million to pay for that. So, you know, the House is got, you know, when we get outside the budget window, we're committing to an $800,000 payment. The Senate to a $287 million, and the governor $671 million. And then finally, and then we can just, you know, get into the fight over it, is I just wanted to have folks look at what the ongoing, just to spend a little more time on what is the ongoing commitment here to all these business tax reductions. And so these aren't the current windows that we're in right now. This is just, what are the governor, the Senate, and the House proposing to do that are going to make permanent commitments to the size of the state budget? And so if you look at the governor, he's got the angel investment credit, the corporate franchise tax repeal. I mean, he gets to zero. Capital equipment sales tax exemption, Green Jobs Z small business investment tax credit. The Senate's proposing a qualified high tech credit, a small business investment tax credit, a 10% income tax cut subtraction pass-through entity, historic rehab tax credit, a film credit, an upfront capital exemption, and an ongoing money the House is committing to R&D. Now, I know that, you know, we all have differences on this, but I just think that when you look at the state budget trends report, you know, everything says our revenues are not going to keep up, and our expenditures are growing too fast, health care and other. And I just think in a $6.4 billion deficit, we can't be making ongoing commitments that we have no idea how we're going to pay for them. Now, you know, I think the people who are willing to raise taxes to pay for them are being more honest. They're saying, yes, they're saying we'll raise a tax and we'll pay for it in a permanent way. I think folks are saying we shouldn't raise any taxes, but we want all this stuff too. I mean, that gets a little harder for me to stomach, quite honestly, especially when you look at the governor's $671 million spending commitment without a way to pay for it, just not in the tax bill, just in the business tax part of the tax bill. This is just in the corporate side. And I just think we all need to be honest. I mean, I think we should talk about if we think that what we need to be doing right now is creating jobs. I mean, I am not one that's convinced that handing out these spending programs creates jobs any quicker, any better, any more efficient, or a better return on the dollar than investing in things like K-12. Or a good commerce system, or a solid healthcare system, or our workforce, or retraining, or, you know, the myriad of other ways that people think for the long term. I mean, I know in the short term, people like these ideas because it gives a sense of hope. And I remember Senator Bach talking about, hey, when Job Z happened, you'd go to these communities and people were really hopeful. You know, and Job Z doesn't work. I mean, all the data shows it's really not working. I mean, it's working in a few places, but the Office of the Legislative Audit Report shows it's really not been a good use of taxpayers' money. And so the fact that things provide hope or make us feel good in the short term doesn't mean they make good financial sense. And I think that job creation, I mean, unfortunately, it's, you know, true to, in my mind, you know, true job creation is you have to think long term. You have to think down the road. Most of these mechanisms that are in these bills are, to me, are very risky ventures. They are putting the risk on the back of the taxpayer without a lot of information to show that anything works. And we just plain old can't afford it. So, you know, I do also want to talk about one of the bills which I did not hear. It was Representative Winkler's, and I know Senator Saltzman, I guess, is going to come down and tell us a little bit about it, but. You know, one of these items is this $164 million for this concept that you would, you know, give money in tax credits to insurance companies and then they would flow money to promoters who then need to back, secure that by taking half the money and securing it in Treasury bonds, and then after they get all their fees and their costs recouped, then they can do some small investing in some capital venture that we don't even know would work. And it's been very it hasn't been working in other states that do it. Its track record is poor, and you know, we'd like to spend some time talking about it because it's a big ticket item in the Senate tax bill. And you know, I know that people disagree with me. I'm fine with that. But I'd like to hear, you know, people make these arguments. The states that have done this are not having good luck with it, and some of them are attempting to repeal them. And it just, in my mind, I don't know where we have the money for this kind of stuff. You know, as I've said, you know, there's a $403.25 million tax increase on businesses in the Senate tax bill. So that pays for those things. But why not just not have the tax increase on business and not have the giveaways? I mean, just current law would be about the same, wouldn't it? So, you know, we want to get into it. I'm sure you got a lot of rebuttal, but I just want to kind of, you know, big picture, let people know where we're at, because we're going to be here all night, so we got a long time to talk about this. But I just think in a $6.4 billion deficit, you know, Senator Bach has courageously raised 2.2. We're doing 1.5. The governor's at a billion. I think buying other stuff means you have to raise more. So if everybody would just stop buying stuff, including the governor, we wouldn't have to raise so much. Or if you don't believe in raising, if people would stop buying stuff, they wouldn't have to cut other things so deeply. So, I mean, I'm putting my values on the table here. I think the House tax bill has done that. I mean, we're not convinced that the way to be playing in the economy for job creation is picking winners and losers. We think we should let the capitalists do it. As capitalists, they do it better than government, and they should do it without taxpayer subsidy. You know, they're adept at taking risk, and for them to now say, it's so risky out there, we can't do it without the taxpayer subsidy, you know, that would be a red flag to everybody. If it's too risky for capitalists to do it, why in the heck should the taxpayers do it? So, you know, I do want to hear from you, Senator Bach, and everybody, and I do want to talk about the Senator Saltzman bill. I think that's just and part of the reason I want to spend time on it is because the governor's supporting it too, and I think he's shouldn't be supporting it either. And I want to convince the Senate that this is a road we don't want to go down, and I want to hear from folks who are advocates for it. So, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I think the issue is, I think you feel the economy has no problem, and I think the Senate feels that Minnesota's economy is in a severe recession, and somebody needs to do something. And I got an email today from former tax chair Senator Doug Johnson. He called me and I said, Doug, send me the specifics. And this is what it says. It says, thanks for agreeing to help on the Cook Spectrum project. Spectrum was shocked to hear that Wells Fargo turned down the loan, as they received so much positive response. Then it tells who they dealt with, because I asked for the details. And it says, of about $2 million project, and it's an assisted living building in a small town I represent, 25% was equity, 25% was SBA, and 50% was a loan from Wells Fargo. The individual who had been working with Spectrum Healthcare had recommended the loan to the executive committee, and it was turned down. Madam Chair, the problem is we have financial markets that are absolutely froze up. I know this company. They've got a number of facilities. I know the CEO. This is a rock-solid project, and we're looking for 50% of the money in a loan, and the bank won't do it. So do we just throw up our hands and not do anything to try and jumpstart some of these projects? And if the banks feel like somebody needs to take some of the risk out, I just think that's a reasonable place for the taxpayer to play a role when your economy is in a severe recession. So we just fundamentally disagree. But I've met with developer after developer after developer, starting with, frankly, the first week of the session, a big Twin City developer came in to see me and had a lot of projects, showed me a list of 16 projects that were ready to go, and not one could get financing. The owners wanted to go, they were ready to go, but no financing. And this is just the most recent one, the email I got today in a small town that I represent. And so, Madam Chair, there's a real problem out there. Owners have real projects that are ready to go, and they can't get financing. And for the state to just say, well, there's nothing we can do, I guess. We just throw our hands up and our citizens draw unemployment until their unemployment runs out and their health care runs out. And then they go over to Senator Berglund's committee and they qualify for Minnesota Care and more state services. And we just sit here on our hands and say, well, we can't afford to help. We can't afford to do anything to help bring the state out of the recession. I think the Senate just doesn't agree with that principle. The Senate thinks the state has some role when you're in a deep recession to try and stimulate the economy. And, you know, I mean, the most recent example is the email I got today. And I'm going to try and meet with the bank and see if I can find out what the objections are. But it's just not acceptable for us that this session be only about balancing the state budget. And we all go home. And, you know, Madam Chair, you and I have got a job, and we've got health insurance, but a whole lot of us have got a lot of constituents that don't. And they've got family members that are finishing up their college degrees, and they're moving home because there's no job for them. And I think they're looking to people like us to try and do something. And clearly we have a problem. I don't think anybody in this room thinks we don't have a problem in the financial markets. And to just do nothing other than balance the budget just seems unacceptable to me. So we just kind of have a fundamental disagreement, Madam Chair, and, you know, you may end up getting your way. And we don't do any of this stuff, and I think Minnesota loses. But, you know, it takes both of us, and it takes the governor to get anything signed into law. And I just think somebody needs to do something on behalf of our constituents that we represent. And I'm sure I'm surprised that you don't think that doing the upfront exemption on capital equipment is a good idea. I thought we all thought that was worth doing. But I noticed you didn't put it in. It's never scored less money. There's probably, in my time here, probably never been a better time to try and do that. Reduce the cost of capital upfront 6.5% on July 1st. And that just may make the difference to build the bridge to some project being bankable. So, and I'm sure, I guess in the next 12, 13 days, we're going to probably talk about this quite a bit, but I just don't think it's acceptable to just pretend like there's not a problem out there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying, but the insinuation that the House plan didn't put jobs as a paramount issue is not correct. But we do it a little different way in that we realize that it's more than just balancing the budget. It's, you know, how can you position the state so when the economy is ready to take off, we're ready to take off. But we don't, as the chair mentioned, we're not going to raise taxes on a lot of different businesses and then pull a few out that we're going to try to provide benefits to. So you get a few winners and a lot of losers. So we've taken a lot more probably targeted approach as looking to try to rise all boats with the rising tide. And, you know, we've got the Section 179 expensing. We've got the R&D credit. Got the single sales factor. But also, we hold the line on property taxes, which I think is a huge benefit to commercial industry. We have very little property tax increases in the plan. The county option reform probably saves about 1,500 jobs. And so it might be a little different approach. We don't pick the winners and losers in the plan. We think a consistent plan that hopefully deals with all businesses will help the economy, and maybe more important, and is raising revenues in an honest way, which I know the Senate also does, in protecting those investments that are going to be crucial for our economy, which is education, our transportation system, making sure as many people have health care as possible, keeping property taxes down. I mean, all of the investments in this, or all the increases in revenue go towards that. So we firmly believe here that you need to do more than balance the budget, as you're stating. But we think we do it a little differently. But we certainly, I mean, one of the main things we had in mind was either saving jobs or how can we create jobs or position ourselves for job growth when the economy takes off.
Madam Chair, I think what might be helpful, I know you've got very capable staff that produced all these spreadsheets for us. If we could see a spreadsheet of the Senate's total budget, you know, 10 and 11, 12 and 13, the governor's budget, 10 and 11, 12 and 13, and then the Senate's budget, 12 and 13, and kind of see if we all, I think there's been plenty of criticism of the governor's proposal for having about a $2.5 or $2.6 billion deficit in details, and I think the members of the Senate were pretty courageous in trying to get the state back into structural balance, but I don't think I've ever seen actually a spreadsheet that shows whether the House's budget is in balance going into the next biennium. So if we could provide that, I think that would be helpful.
Well, and I think that's for the finance chairs, if you're talking about the whole budget, but you're right. I mean, the Senate's the one who's got it. So, I mean, maybe Senator Cohen and Senator and Representative Carlson want to provide us with that. But the Senate gets to structural balance quicker than the House, and the House gets there quicker than the governor. That's true. Absolutely true. The House is willing to do the shift, as is the governor. So we're the same on that. I'm trying to focus on this right now because I don't believe if we had a deficit or a surplus, this is a good idea. I just have never been convinced that this stuff works. If it were this simple, I mean, every state would be doing this, and the data would be there to show that all these things work, and it's just not there. I mean, you know, I just would say that, you know, to the comment that maybe the House doesn't think there's a problem, we know there's a huge jobs problem. Huge jobs problem, and the Senate does too. I think everybody knows that. I think the governor knows that too. We just all disagree with how you solve the problem. And does somebody need to do something now? Yes, I agree. I just don't think this is it. I don't think it's government's job to deal with frozen financial markets. I don't think that the fact that, you know, people are having a hard time getting credit is something that the state of Minnesota needs to solve for the financial institutions that are the risk takers it may not be apparent to everybody here, but for folks who followed the votes I've taken and the positions I've taken on business taxes since I've been in the legislature is I've been pretty pro-business. And in my mind, it is not pro-business to raise business taxes on everyone through the state property tax, and then have some people benefit from how that money is spent. I just think that the kind of standard fiscally prudent sort of economist method, and I know I get criticized for being pure or whatever, is that the best thing you can do for business is provide the stuff business needs to have a good workforce and to compete in a global economy, take down as many possible barriers as you can in regulations, which is not what the tax committee does. That's for other committees to deal with regulation. But to have the broadest possible, lowest possible tax rates. You know, just tax everybody low. Don't tax some people a bunch and some people none. And that's really what all these winners and losers do. They let some people not pay taxes. Like, don't pay property taxes if you're in Job Z, or you get this angel investor credit, or you get, you know, this small business investment credit where we're going to give you all the taxpayers' money and you're going to create something with that, maybe. And you know what? If you don't, there's no consequence. None. The state's just out the money. There's no take for the taxpayer. I mean, you know, I've tried to talk to people when they've asked me about these provisions. You know, if it's such a good deal, then why don't you just give us 50% of the cut? And nobody will do that. I mean, you know, if I was asking Senator Dibble to invest in my new company, I think he'd want a return on that. But, you know, the taxpayer is supposed to invest in these things but not get a return on that, just sort of a hope that it works. And so, you know, I haven't been convinced by these. I guess, you know, I do think the House tax bill is doing a lot. I was the chief author of lowering the corporate tax rate last year. And the governor wasn't interested last year when I was the author of it, and we had money, because I thought a competitive advantage thing to do would be to lower the corporate tax. Now, I didn't lower it to getting rid of it in all time, but I paid for it by getting rid of taking all these winners and losers and getting rid of them, and I paid for my tax cut. Nobody was interested in that. Now, when we're in a huge deficit and we can't afford to give out tax cuts, the governor's proposing a big corporate tax cut. And I know you're not, Senator, but you know, the bills are proposing these, in my mind, these sort of giveaways, and some of them are really well-intentioned with really good people, but, you know, I have proposed lowering business taxes, but I think more importantly, the House is not raising business taxes. The House does not raise business taxes, and the House doesn't give out tax cuts to winners, you know, picking people. We're just saying we're in a deficit. We cannot afford this kind of ongoing spending and make the deficit bigger, and we're going to choose. And I think it's interesting that, you know, the House really hasn't received any credit for this from the business community, quite frankly. The House has made a conscious decision both this year and the last 2 years to not raise business taxes on the state property tax. So, I mean, there should be value to that for people. I mean, that would be something we could do, but we're not. And we're not picking out other, we haven't proposed raising the corporate tax. You know, so, I mean, you know, I think in this economy, to be somebody that's just plain old not being asked to be taxed a whole bunch more, and I, you know, in fairness, I'm taxing business a little too. I'm repealing some and buying some stuff, and on net, there is some revenue raising going on through FOCs and tax havens, yes. And do I think the governor is going to support that? No. I'm just showing my preferences. So in the world of reality, nope, I'm not handing out all these kind of business tax reduction subsidies, but I'm not raising taxes on business either. And I think that's the fiduciary responsibility, that's the steady course, that every dollar more we do there is, every one of these programs means we're going to have less K-12 or more people lose health care or less of everything else that is government's role, because this stuff is not government's role. And I think we stink at it. I mean, I think I have a lot of respect for business owners and business leaders and the folks who work in this area, and that I'm not one of those people. But, you know, I can at least, you know, my take on what I hear from people when I meet with CEOs privately or when I meet with companies is there aren't a lot of people asking for government to give them stuff. They're sort of saying kind of stay out of our way and keep taxes as low as you can. It is the unique business that comes here and asks for something, because most businesses understand that they're not asking for something, and they all pay more when a few get something. And so, you know, I'm just not persuaded by this. I am saying this as much for the Senate conferees' benefit as for Commissioner Innes and Assistant Commissioner Cadoon to relay my feelings to the governor. I think the governor knows how I feel. But the governor and the Senate are united on a lot of this stuff. And I think, you know, maybe the commissioner wants to weigh in. I just don't know how we defend this in a deficit. I mean, an ongoing, you know, the Senate, the governor's tax bill, you know, back to the governor's, he's creating new spending commitments in the first biennium of $251 million, second biennium of $424 million, and third of $671 million. And yes, he pays for it by cutting people. Straight up, that's not my priority. And it hasn't been the House's priority to cut people deeper so that folks can get these business tax cuts. So, Commissioner, I mean, have at it. Welcome.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I figure the rubber hit the road eventually here, and this is a good discussion to start that. Well, first and foremost, I think I disagree with the Madam Chair's assertion that they're not raising business taxes in the House bill. I mean, you've already mentioned you're repealing FOCs, the foreign royalty deduction, even the increase on the individual income tax will hit a lot of pass-through entities. 90% of the businesses in Minnesota are organized as pass-through entities, so that is, in fact, also a business tax increase. So I don't think anybody has clean hands between the House and Senate on increasing business taxes. I think both bills dramatically, in our view, increase business taxes. And, you know, people talk about winners and losers and picking winners and losers. I think it's a matter of perspective in a lot of instances, because I think you can be argued it's being strategic. When you have limited resources at your disposal, in an ideal world, if we were operating from an economics textbook, you're right. Let's lower the marginal tax rates. Let's make the base as broad as possible. At a time of scarcity, as we are experiencing today, I think you got to do some strategic, targeted. You can call it picking winners and losers, but it's really about being strategic and trying to get the best bang for the buck. And I think you guys acknowledge it to a certain extent with the R&D credit. I mean, that is picking winners and losers. You're picking R&D-intensive industries to give an additional tax break to. And it goes against much of what Madam Chair has talked about in committee. But I think it's a good thing, and we would embrace that change. So whether it's being strategic, surgical, or picking winners and losers, I think in this kind of environment it's needed. And I think not all jobs are created equal, and there are certain industries we should want to foster and cultivate. One of them is the bioscience industry in Minnesota. And I think it's giving an R&D credit, enhancing the R&D credit, foreign royalty deduction are all things that enhance an industry that we are kind of blessed to have that industry cultivated here in Minnesota, and we want to maintain that economic advantage. So, you know, we can look at these different, we have some overlap between the Senate and the governor. I think we try to do a combination of targeted tax reductions in addition to broad-based with the corporate income tax reduction across the board. Is it ideal? Is it perfect? No. But, I mean, increasing taxes by $1.6 billion in the case of the House and $1.5 billion in the case of the House, I think $2.6 billion in the case of the Senate, I mean, that's a non-starter from the administration standpoint. And I don't think any bill that raises taxes by that much can be called a jobs-friendly bill.
Commissioner, what revenue raising level is a jobs friendly bill?
We think when you're in the midst of probably the worst recession since World War II, we think tax increases are, as a general rule, a bad idea in this kind of environment.
But the billion the governor's raising is okay, that's jobs friendly.
The billion on the shift,
his revenue, that one too. That kind of revenue raising is jobs friendly?
It's more jobs-friendly than a direct tax increase on employers and job creators and families. And I think if we have to make a decision between the state's pocketbook and the families and taxpayers' pocketbook, we're gonna err on the side of protecting the taxpayers' pocketbook. And that's what we've done. And we've been criticized. We're not completely balanced in 12 and 13. You know, to balance that is going to have an adverse impact on a very difficult economy. And so those decisions will have to be made down the road. But we think that the first admonition the governor had for me was we need to do no harm to our job creators and employers. We are in a difficult, to say the least, understatement time. And the first thing is do no harm. And what can we do with our limited resources to try to move the meter, try to create some job creation, prime the pump as far as economic development. And we did our best to come up with what we think is a pretty balanced, fiscally responsible package.
Well, and Commissioner, I'll just say, you know, cutting people has the exact same effect. So, you know, having the idea that tax increases are hurting people, that's true. So are cutting people's level of government that they want. That hurts them too. So, you know, the governor isn't pure in this either. I mean, he's proposing lots of cuts. And, you know, I guess you could have you could be an employee and you either get a tax increase or you lose your health care, you know. Neither one of those are good things. So I think it's often sort of characterized that tax increases are bad, but cuts are okay, and I reject that. I think they're both bad. I think we have a really fragile economy, and people are in big trouble, and I think we need to do as little of both as we possibly can. That's why I've always been a shift supporter, and it's unpopular, but I've always been a fan of the shift, and the reason is you can avoid deeper cuts that hurt people more or larger tax increases that hurt people more to get you through the tough times. And I hope the Senate will take the shift. I'm with the governor on that. I think we need to get there. But, you know, I guess the frustration I have is with the governor's proposal is this ongoing commitment to pay for this stuff when we don't have money. And I guess, you know, I can't speak for Senator Bach, but I think, you know, the House and Senate have an understanding about where the bottom line revenue might end up by the end here, and it's probably not the size of these two bills. The governor has $1 billion, so will the governor, when or if everyone says, you know what, there's not going to be new revenue, let's not have any revenue because the Senate tax increases are too high, and so are the houses, and the Senate and the House saying we're not going to do that securitization thing. Is the governor going to drop pushing for all his new spending? Because, you know, to me it seems that anybody who's bringing revenue forward, and this is just the House now, should be trying to not entertain new spending. So it's sort of like you lose your job, you probably shouldn't go out and buy new clothes and, you know, new stuff to decorate your bathroom with because you just lost your job. So we shouldn't be doing new spending. But if everybody, you know, gets to the point where they think around here in all three bodies that we're probably not going to have a lot of revenue to work with, can we all agree to drop all our new spending initiatives? I mean, that just seems, and that still won't give us out of the deficit. That'll just help us not grow the deficit bigger. Do you think the governor is going to, can he get to a point in the next 13 days where he'll say, I'll drop all my, you know, $700 million in new spending initiatives that grow the deficit and, you know, stop talking about revenue too? Commissioner, can you?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can't speak for the other spending categories beyond the tax realm, but I know he is strongly committed to his tax reductions in the bill. And I think he would echo much of what Senator Bach said today, that it's not enough about doing budgetary triage in the next 2 weeks. We need to do more than triage. We need to do something that's affirmatively helps our economy. And so I think he's going to be very committed to having a net tax reduction at the end of the day.
Senator Bach, it's going to be a really long 13 days. What do you think?
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman is sitting so patiently over there, and I know she loved to be engaged in this conversation because she has a passion about job creation and small Minnesota startup companies that just aren't big enough to leverage any capital yet. The banks won't trust them, somebody needs to be able to take a risk on some of those new little innovative ideas that maybe like Medtronic started in somebody's garage. And those things are happening every week at the University of Minnesota, truly one of the economic engines of our state. And it just would be a shame if some of those new little startup technologies and bioscience and medical devices and green technology that we nurture there and bring to a point to take them off of the table to a prototype to the next step, if we don't provide some help to leverage, take a little of the risk out to bring that work on the table to the next level. And we don't know where some of these new startup technologies are going to go. I remember, Madam Chair, when I went to normally you'd call it a groundbreaking, probably, at the Sedan Underground Mine. The University of Minnesota has an experiment going on with the Fermilab in Chicago. And I went over there, took the mine elevator shaft down, and they had scientists from all over the world there. This was a few years ago. They banged a sledgehammer on the wall 1,500 feet underground or whatever it was to commence the building of an underground science lab where they were going to wind up an accelerator, a beam, shoot it through the crust of the earth, and it would go through a detector at Sedan underground, and it needed to be out of ultraviolet light, and that's why they selected that Sedan underground mine. And I remember going there thinking, what in the world is this all about? And the scientists spoke from all over the world, and we had scientists from the University of Minnesota there. And I remember one of my newspaper editors, when it came time for the questions and the scientists were all done speaking, he said, when you find out what it is you want to know, what are you going to do with the information? And one of the scientists came to the table and said, we don't know. And Madam Chair, last Friday, that same experiment, the University of Minnesota received another grant from the National Science Foundation. And up on the Ash River Trail in the north part of my district, they're going to build another lab, about a $50 million construction project. The whole thing's about $250 million. And the University of Minnesota is now going to study the off-axis beam of that accelerated atom coming from Chicago, going through Sedan as it breaks the crust of the earth at the Ash River Trail by the Hoyers National Park. They're going to set up another detector for that beam to go through. And Madam Chair, we don't know what all that means, except there is some incredible research going on at the University of Minnesota. And we have just the most innovative people in this state. But it's too risky for banks. So we need somebody willing to take some of the risk out and some of these startup new ideas. And we don't know where they're going to lead. But things like the angel investor credit in this bill, some people are willing to take the risk on that. And providing some kind of a state incentive to bring those kind of technological developments to the next level, I think is a good risk with some taxpayers' dollars, because we just don't know where it leads. We don't know what happens next. I marvel by little things. How my cell phone works. You know? But there's a lot of people doing some really, really incredible work in this state. We're fortunate to have the kind of research institution that we do. And providing small incentive through the Angel Investor Program just seems to me to be a good long-term investment for the state. Small amount of money.
Well, I know Representative Margaret wants to be recognized, but I do want to hear from Senator Saltzman. Maybe Senator Marty, I know, has the opposite view on that bill, and we never heard it, so I would like to hear from both of them. But, you know, I just want to say the National Science Foundation and the U of M and all that stuff, that's great. That's government. That's not private. So, I mean, I could support taking all the spending and all these bills and just giving it to the U of M and giving it to K-12 and giving it to government stuff. I mean, none of these things go to the U of M. So, I mean, we should be, that's what, you're making my point. I mean, we should be investing, if we're going to spend this kind of money, let's invest in that kind of stuff. And I've one who said, and I'm in a minority in this too, in my caucus, just like I don't mind the shift, I think that Representative Hausman and Senator Langseth should have had a massive bonding bill. If we want to put people to work quickly and have things that are shovel ready, not most of these tax credit programs don't even take place for 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, we'll be long out of the recession by then. So they're not stimulus things for jobs. They're people succeeding at a time when people feel desperate, in my opinion. But I think those two chairs should have had a ton of money. That's public money, taxpayers' money, to put into safe public projects, and they should have queued up as many as they could that the government was going to do anyhow, and that's the better way. You know, so, I mean, I just have to be honest. When you say, you know, the banks won't take the risk, so someone has to step up and do it, that just makes me feel sick to my stomach. If the banks won't take the risk, that ought to say something to somebody. They're really well situated to make these decisions. They weigh the cost and benefit of investment risk every day. Government does not, and we are ill-equipped, and we don't have, you know, we can't negotiate a bottom line with anybody. I mean, if whether it's the Mall of America provision in the bill or any other thing that's going on here, we don't know what they really need to make it go. We just have to believe them, and we can be wrong, we can be right, you know, we don't know. I just think this is not, you know, I read Commissioner Inas's interview in the Legal Ledger a year or two ago, and he said that one of the books that really influenced his life is a book that I have read, and everyone should read that this summer, and I don't know how to pronounce the name. I think it's Ayn Rand, but it's called Atlas Shrugged, and for anybody who thinks they're pro-business and thinks they're a capitalist, you better go reread it, because nobody who's truly a free market capitalist is asking for the government to give him a handout. And I remember Commissioner Inas said he read that book, and it influenced him, and it influenced me. And you know, if you have time this summer to read it, please go read it. I mean, that is not a truly fiscally conservative, even slash Republican. The typical belief system there is keep the government out of it, keep the taxes as low as possible, as broad as possible, and stay out of it. So, you know, it's confusing to me, not with you, Senator, but with a lot of people around here, you know, in both sides of the aisle who claim to be sort of the free market capitalists who support these sort of items. I don't understand. I actually think the corporate tax cut, if you could get rid of it forever, would be a good thing. We just can't afford it right now. That actually, I think, is a straight up good tax policy that isn't picking winners and losers. It's just saying it's a tax that isn't working very well. It's hard to get people to do it. It's hard to collect it. It's confusing. But it also, before we went into the deficit, it was raising over $1 billion a year. So, I mean, now is not the time to throw out $1 billion a year, in my estimation. But I think if we could get back to a better economy, there's something we should transition to. And I want to give the Governor's 21st Century Commission Task Force credit. I mean, they came up with a number of these things, and they actually did pay for it through what? A broad-based low tax. Through reforming the sales tax. I mean, that's, to me, an honest way to approach this stuff, but it's just a fundamental disagreement, and I think, you know, we need to get it out there because we've got to get done this year, and I think it's the House, you know, as the House tax chair, I want to bring it up because it's, you know, You got the governor with you. Madam He's Chair. On board on this. Represent or Senator Scott or Fox, sorry.
Madam Chair, I'm the night of the Ranger Party, I met with
was there too.
I met with a doctor and researcher from the University of Minnesota who's been working on, for lack of a better word, let me call it a moss project. And today they're getting moss from New Zealand. It's being flown in, and they've taken a process where they compress it and use it as a water filtration system. And they believe it will revolutionize the way we treat wastewater in the world. And they're interested in taking it to the next level, and the university has discovered that the moss in northern Minnesota has the same kind of characteristics that the moss in New Zealand has. And so we've been spending some time with them to figure out how we can take it from the bench kind of to the next level. Exciting technology developed at the university. There is some incredible things happening. But, Madam Chair, no bank is going to do that. A venture capitalist needs to do that. And the state providing some incentive to take some of the risk out for people that take incredible risks through venture capital. The state providing some incentive to make sure that those investments and that job creation happens in Minnesota. Because unfortunately, Madam Chair, it's not a pure and perfect world. And other states do that. They do provide tax incentives for venture capitalists that are willing to invest in small startup, high-tech type things. So it just would be a shame if some of the incredible work is being done at the university because Minnesota was unwilling to provide some kind of an incentive for the venture capitalists that those kind of developments happened maybe in neighboring states or maybe further away, because other states want that new startup technology that's being developed at places like University of Minnesota. And I'm sure it's just something that we're probably not going to come to an agreement on, but it's a place where we probably fundamentally disagree. I'm excited about the future. But I'd like those companies that were started here in a lab in Minnesota to develop to be. And 3M, Madam Chair, started in my district. In 1902, spent a couple of years there trying to figure out how to make sandpaper in Two Harbors, and were this close to going bankrupt when they moved to the Twin Cities. So seeing what's happened to a company like 3M, how that's happened in Minnesota, I want this state to take some risk on the next 3M so that some of this exciting stuff that's being done at places like the university, we take it to the next level here, that it isn't some other state who's willing to provide a little incentive to the venture capitalist to invest there, that those things don't go somewhere else and the next 3M happens in Iowa or in Kansas or pick a state. I just think there's some credible opportunity in Minnesota, and I think it's worth putting some taxpayers' investment.
Representative Mark Horton.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I want to go back to this revenue debate a little bit. And Commissioner Ines had mentioned that this is a bad time to raise taxes on citizens. And in fact, on Governor Plenty's last letter to us, he says, "I urge you not to raise taxes on the citizens of Minnesota in these challenging economic times." And yet, from Commissioner, your own department, the governor's plan will raise $613 million of property taxes on folks around this state, which begs the question sometimes, who are the citizens that the governor's talking about? Because if you were to ask a senior citizen on a fixed income which plan they would rather have, the House plan or the governor's plan, I'm willing to bet they would say the House plan, unless they're heavy drinkers. And even then, I don't know if it can make up for the property tax increases, or if it's a farmer who has a lot of their dollars in the property taxes, or a young family. And the governor's able to help balance the budget in the first term because he cuts about $536 million out of property tax aids and credits. But with that, there's a consequence. You know, in some things, if you cut education, you cut health care, you take people off of health care, you know, increase school size on classrooms. But here, when you cut in the property tax aids and credits, you're going to raise property taxes. And that 613 does not include the huge cuts in the renter's credit of $50 million a year, which, again, hits probably about 30% of seniors or disabilities living in those rentals. So I guess my question to the commissioner is, you know, what makes raising property taxes better than raising income taxes? I mean, we've got to be honest here. Everyone is raising taxes. But, you know, when you read statements like this or you hear statements that this is not the time to raise taxes on citizens, not recognizing that property taxes are taxes. And I guess I know we've talked about this before, Commissioner, but it's a property tax increase. It doesn't matter what pocket it comes out of, it's a tax increase. And I guess what makes property tax, at least in the governor's eyes, more appealing, I guess, than an income tax?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, we've always acknowledged that the governor's budget cuts have some property tax implications. I try to be pretty straightforward about that. I think one material difference is that the numbers that you just cited, and in the governor's letter to the conferees, he did not include the property tax impacts of repealing levy limits, whatever LGA market value credit cuts you did have. We also did not include the local option sales tax authority and see how many counties would have imposed that, because that could be another $200 million-plus tax increase. So some of those that have some local discretion, like the sales tax authority and the property tax, we didn't include in the aggregate number of tax increases. But we've acknowledged that based on the way we forecast property tax impacts, that the governor's budget, which certainly have some property tax impacts, I think somewhat of the difference between what the House and Senate are advocating and what we're advocating is that the tax increases that you're advocating in your bill are an absolute certainty. We pretty much know what they're going to be. You're going to put the rate at 9%, it's going to generate X. You're going to eliminate the foreign royalty deduction, it's going to generate Y. You know, there is some uncertainty about what the property tax is going to do, especially in these uncertain times. There's a number out there. It's our best guess on a behavioral and what the local units of government will do. But we know, we think that's we probably think that's the lesser of two evils at this point, that some of these cuts are absolutely necessary in order to kind of balance the budget. There's a probability that there'll be some property tax increases as a result. And we think that's lesser of two evils than absolutely increasing state taxes by a billion plus. We think that is the less ideal option.
Madam Chair. Please. And I appreciate that, Commissioner, but when the governor says, I urge you not to raise taxes on the citizens of Minnesota in these challenging economic times, isn't that being hypocritical from what you just said? Because he's raising taxes on the citizens of this state.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, the letter could have been more precise. We should have qualified that with state taxes. That would have been a more precise, accurate representation. No question about it.
Thank you. Others? Okay, we're going to hear from Senator Saltzman and Senator Marty, if he's still here. These are people for and against the Small Business Investment Act that was heard by the Senate. And it's in the Senate bill, and we didn't hear it in the House. And I just want to explain again why we didn't hear it in the House. We told all members that if you had a bill that cost money, you had to pay for it by raising a tax, or we weren't going to hear it. We made a couple exceptions. We heard the governor's budget. We heard couple vision bills from the majority, and we heard the 21st Century Commission, although they did raise the money to pay for it. But everything else, we gave members the option of saying, if you want to raise the money to pay for this, we'll hear your bill. And they didn't want to, mostly. Both sides of the aisle. And this bill costs $150 million. So we do want to hear a little bit. I did meet with some of the people on this bill in my office who talked to me about it, and you know, I was not convinced. And since then, I'll just be straight up, Senator Saltzman, I've done some reading on it, and those states that are doing it, it's not working too well. So, and I have some information on that from
some of the review that's been done on these, and of course you're here to defend it, and others are against it, but because it's such an expensive item in the Senate tax bill, we wanted to understand it. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I really appreciate being here. And, you know, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have to do these kinds of programs, but we are in a very trying time. And just to sort of explain a little bit of the background, the last year I have spent significant time, and I know Representative Mahoney has been a partner in crime with me on this, in trying to really understand the process that new products go through in research. And we continue to be a brain trust for ideas. And as a legislature, we have done our job in investing in the U of M, the Bioscience Center, and we're doing all those things to create the ideas. But an idea doesn't mean anything if you can't take it from the lab bench to the workplace. And so along the way, as these emerging ideas come up, the idea of having some type of early seed money, early stage capital, venture capitalists, and I am not an expert in this area, but there are very different pots of money along the way and stages as these ideas are brought forward, and there is a risk to them. And so along the way, as these, you know, ideas are brought forward, it's who's going to invest in them, and it's not banks. It's going to be private investors, and I think that that's one thing to understand. At some point, the banks come in, but in these early stages, it's very important to be able to tap dollars. Sometimes it's family and friends, and then you get to another stage, and sometimes you can get, you know, grant money if you're selected, but at the same time, you need to keep moving the idea forward. And so what is happening in Minnesota right now is that we don't have this program. And while we have incredibly wonderful ideas coming out of, again, our university and also spin-offs from some of our large companies where you have people who have done research and are now going off on their own, and they have these wonderful ideas, and other states are swooping down into Minnesota and plucking them out because they need capital, and these other states have these programs. What's very disturbing is that one of those states is about 10 miles from my house. And that's across the river in Wisconsin, and they have been extremely successful with what they call their Act 255 and doing angel investor programs and also expanding what you want to call the CAPCO program or this insurance pool program, and has been so successful that they are expanding that program this year. And I think you'll see in the Star Tribune tomorrow a very troubling story of a company that came out of the University of Minnesota with great promise, that has discovered a product that can save hundreds of thousands of lives. But that company is having problems raising the dollars in Minnesota, and so earlier this week we learned that they probably are going to Wisconsin and that Madison has put together a plan, and in technology transfer, you know, we always talk about, you know, that I guess business should stay out of this, or that the state should stay out of this. But what we're finding in terms of tech transfer is that those states who are most successful bring together the research from, like, the on the universities and academia. You bring together your public in terms of policy, in terms of your tax policy, in terms of these kind of programs, and also private business. And there is a way to work together. It is very important because this is really the new economy. So when we look at Minnesota, we see the exciting things that are happening, not just within our medical device, our biobusiness, but in our energy areas. These ideas need a different kind of capital, and it's really private money. And so these dollars are not handouts to millionaires. It's really about people who have resources and saying, take a risk. Take a risk in growing jobs. And in exchange for that, we're going to give you a tax credit. The way that this is structured is that they don't get a tax credit the next day. These dollars have to be put to work. And they're put to work, and they're growing jobs. And as you said earlier, the fact that, you know, if we put $1 million into a shovel-ready product, we have jobs right away. But in terms of sustained economic growth, if we're losing the seed corn here in Minnesota, and that's where I think, again, we are brain trust. We're still a brain trust. We have these great ideas. And we don't have the resources that are going to be needed to keep these companies here and grow. We're going to lose them. And over the past 3 months, as I've worked on this project and this particular legislation, some of the companies that were going to come testify in favor of it are gone. They've gone other places. And those are jobs. And maybe they're small companies now, but they will grow into larger companies. And the issue is that you could talk about this and say, well, what does that do for people who aren't, you know, a PhD or a technology person, is that every technology job grows many, many other jobs in other sectors. So we need to look at this. I know if you're a purist and you talk about tax credits, you could say, do we need this? Well, if everybody was a purist, perhaps not. But when you see what's happening in other states, and it's not just about come here, come there. It's also about the private capital that is there that we need to leverage. We've also had testimony that you can look at how much money this actually will leverage in terms of the actual tax credit. But there's other there are other charts of where it leverages additional money on top of that. And what I think is concerning about here in Minnesota right now is what we're hearing from the people who are out there on the front line, and we've tried to listen to them, and they're really disappointed because they want to keep companies here, and yet this is where all these programs are in other states. Is that if we can really put a sign out to people that we are back in business. Because right now people have this sense of the dollars aren't here, there's no incentives here, to get the dollars I have to go somewhere else. Some of my constituents have moved their emerging technology companies to Hudson because then they qualify for these dollars. And that is very troubling because Wisconsin is going to really benefit from that, and yet the company itself was started here. So I think if we could have Mr. Cassidy talk a little bit about this program, a little bit more like specifics about it. There is, if you do a Google on CAPCO, you're going to find a lot of information that is going to talk about the early stages of this program and how it didn't work. And as we know with many things, I'm working on some charter school legislation, and I could be in that committee right now. We've learned some things. We've had some growing pains, and as a result of that, we're going to put together better legislation. So I would say that what we're doing here is that what has worked in other states and what hasn't worked really has put together a better bill. And so some of the information that you've received, I believe from Senator Marty, from Dr. Julia, I think it's Dr. Rubin in Washington, D.C., was part of some testimony. We have pages of other testimony from that same meeting where really people talked about how successful it's been. Some of the data that was used in this report is from when the program was first started. So there's very, very good information on how many jobs have been grown. So I hope the House will consider this, because I would really hate to see some of our most promising companies in Minnesota feel like they have to go elsewhere in order to keep growing.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. Mr. Cassidy, welcome.
Madam Chair, Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street and Dinard. I represent a coalition of venture capital firms, including Advantage Capital. I have Mr. Tony Toops with me today that can provide some testimony as well. But let me say that Senator Saltzman has crystallized this perfectly, I think. We don't have capital. There are companies that are in desperate need of capital, and if they don't get it, they're either going to move, they're going to go out of business, or they're going to sell their product to someone else. I also like to make the nexus with what Senator Bach was getting to at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has one big problem, commercialization of its research. It doesn't do it very well. It knows it doesn't do it very well, and it needs the money to do it. This program has done this. This program in Wisconsin has commercialized research out of the University of Wisconsin by setting up a separate venture capital pool just for that purpose, and it's been doing it for years. Let me get to the basics of this program just to remind people that might not have heard this bill in the House. First and foremost, what this program does is leverage the reserves of insurance companies that are doing business in the state of Minnesota. They've got reserves. They have capital. They invest it. They don't invest it here now. They should be invested in here now. So what this does is it has the Department of Deed, and you can pick whatever department you want to run this program, but Deed is the one designated in the bill. They certify investment managers, one of those of which may be Advantage Capital, who's with me today. This program has been implemented in 9 other states, 9 other jurisdictions. It's been reauthorized 28 times. And, Madam Chair, I am unaware of any attempt to ever repeal this program. There certainly have been attempts to take the tax credit dollars after the program has been put in place. Now, let me get back to the basics of the program. After the investment managers are chosen by and certified by the Department of Economic Development, they go out on the street into insurance companies and raise the capital from insurance company reserves. They pool that money. As an example, Advantage Capital may pool $25 million in one of the venture capital pools. They have one or two people on the ground in Minnesota that goes out and finds those companies that need that capital. These companies that need this capital are not chosen by politicians. They're not chosen by task forces. They are chosen by investment professionals that know what they're doing and that work with these companies and help manage these companies and help these companies grow. This program does not survive unless it's successful and generates new jobs and generates new revenues for the state. The other point is that we keep talking about this program going into perpetuity. This program is only a 4 or 5 year program. Once the tax credits hit, they only go for four or five years in this bill, the way it's written by Senator Bach's committee. It ends. It will have to be reauthorized if it's successful. This legislature will make that judgment at that time. Many, many legislatures around the country have made those judgments and have reauthorized this program for tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Right now, the state of Tennessee, the governor has announced that this is going to be his program for economic development, so he's pursuing that within the Tennessee legislature. I think it's under reauthorization in a couple of other states. Texas last year reauthorized $200 million. This year, they're coming back for another $200 million. So with that said, one last point I'd like to make with you is that if you were to approve this program, this would be the first program, the first time that this program has been authorized for less than 100%, a 100% tax credit, and for more than 3 years. So we have pushed this to the limit to try and make it as attractive as possible for insurance companies to participate in the program and to make it successful for the long term.
Yeah. Representative Marquardt?
Mr. Cassidy, I didn't hear a lot of specifics on how this actually works.
Okay.
I heard about how all these other states kind of love this plan, although I don't know if they all do. But I heard about insurance companies. I heard about investment managers. You really didn't talk about how it actually gets the businesses to Main Street. So can you kind of, I mean, you got insurance companies, you got deeds, you got the investment managers, you got these businesses. Can you put it all together for me on where the money goes? And if the state was to do $100 million of credits, what actually gets onto the Main Street business?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, what actually gets on the street, in the Senate tax proposal, they authorize $150 million in tax credits. And those tax credits represent an 80% tax credit to insurers, so it translates into roughly $190 million in capital that they'll be able to put out on the street. Now, how does this get put out on the street? Well, first of all, I could probably pick up the paper any given morning in the Star Tribune or the Pioneer Press or on the Internet and find a lot of companies that would like to talk to me if I was an investment manager. That's number one. Number two would be channels, normal channels like the University of Minnesota, some of our business incubators, Life Science Alley, Grow Minnesota, which is run by the Chamber of Commerce, which is nothing but someone going out on the road and talking to businesses every day. We know where these businesses are. We know the businesses to talk to. And with proper promotion, those businesses also find us. But it's up to the investment managers to make sure that they're promoting this program properly so that they can find those businesses that can generate the jobs and generate the revenue growth.
Okay.
Representative Marquardt, can I just... Okay, so I want to understand this, too. And I do want to hear from Senator Marty because he talked to me about this briefly. And honestly, and I heard Senator Saltzman say that, you know, some of the people who are opposing this are wrong or their information's outdated, and we have some of that here, and I can pass that out for folks. But, okay, so I just want to walk through this now because, honestly, the way I understand this, and I don't like the angel investor credit, okay, or the R&D credit, as The commissioner said, but they wore me down on that one, and I thought that was the least objectionable. But the angel investor credit, in my mind, is, and I'm an opponent, a much safer, better, and higher return than this proposal. Okay, so just so you know where I'm coming from. So, because in that situation, you just take the taxpayer's money and you give it to the angel investor. You kind of cut out the middleman. So I'm trying to understand in reading what I've read about this proposal. So if you have the taxpayers, okay, and they're going to give $150 million over 5 years, and it turns off, but it's $150 million in the Senate tax bill. So the taxpayers are going to give $150 million to the insurance companies, if I'm understanding this correctly. And remember, insurance companies already pay less taxes than most businesses in Minnesota because they pay the insurance premiums tax instead of the corporate tax. So they're already kind of better off here. I mean, we could take this bill and instead abolish the insurance premiums tax. That'd be interesting to see how the insurance industry felt about that. But, okay, so we take the 150, it goes to the insurance companies, and they send the money to these Capco people, the promoters, the folks who are going to, you know, set up shop here in Minnesota, and they're going to get management fees, and they're going to get their upfront costs paid for and their startup costs paid for, all with the taxpayers' money. And this is how I understand it. So because the insurance company needs a steady stream of investments because they're not, you know, they're not going to be the people doing the risky ventures because they're insurance companies. They're going to let the promoters do it. The promoters then, if I understand how it's happened in other states, then they have to set up, they go buy treasury bonds to make this risky thing secure. So the insurance companies feel that now it's secure. So they go take, let's say, that $150 million, what number, $50 million of that, and put it into treasury bonds. And then after the company's had its management fees, which I understand the Senate has reduced a little bit compared to most states, and its startup costs and its, you know, Minnesota in-house shop of a couple people and all that stuff's paid for by the taxpayers, and the treasury bonds are invested in to make the insurance companies happy, then the leftover gets sent to be invested in these, you know, whatever they want invested in, where we're actually now getting into the main street. We're going to invest it in these venture capital adventures. So, and we have to do that quickly because the bill is set up that you got to do it quickly. So you might make a decision that's not the best because you're in a hurry now because you got to quick get a return so you can float the rest of the money again, or the money doesn't work. And my understanding is some other states have had to sort of get special legislation to, because they couldn't get the money returned fast enough. They've had to waive things because they didn't meet their targets. But so taking that 150, give it to the insurance company, then flow it down to the promoters, and then, you know, how much of that 150 would have to go into treasury bonds, for example, to make the insurance companies happy? And then, in, you know, after you take out all the management fees and startup costs, you know, how much of that, you know, 150 are you actually going to be able to invest? I mean, I would hope it would be over $100 million, but it's, from what I read, it's probably under 50. So can you shed some light on how all that money would flow?
Madam Chair, let me first start out with just clarifying that once the investment managers are certified by the Department of Economic Development, they go to the insurers and raise the money, okay? They raise the pools of money. Then those investment managers go out and they find the investments on the street. Okay, that's number one. Number two, this doesn't cost the state anything for the first 5 years. This money has to be raised and put on the street immediately. And there are benchmarks in the bill that require them to have a certain portion of that money invested before they can do anything. The other point is that the bill is very prescriptive about what distributions can be made by these investment managers to themselves. It's very prescriptive, I think. And finally, they can't take any profits out of this until they have everything on the street, 100% of the pool of money. So with that, I would like to have my client, Tony Tubes from Advantage Capital, answer your question.
And we'll get to that, sure. But yeah. I want to be clear. I understand how tax credits work. I'm simplifying it.
Right.
Yes. You first have to do the expenditure, raise the money to get the tax credit. So that's how you get the taxpayers' money. So, I mean, if the Senate is putting forward $150 million from the taxpayers, yes, it's not immediate, and that's one of my other objections to the bill because it's out in the tails, so you don't have to count it. So down the road, as you clock it out, you got to count, you know, 15, 30, 45, in the end, okay, whether it's, you know, paying for the, you know, hamburger today or a different day. I mean, the taxpayers have to pay for it if they perform. What I'm saying is that it seems to me that the angel investor credit model gets a much higher return, a much higher performance for pennies on the dollar than something like this, unless I misunderstand it. So you're right. I mean, you're buying, the taxpayers are giving them tax credits that are redeemed later. So that goes to the insurance company. And so what I'm trying to understand is if the insurance companies, you know, the insurance companies have 150 in tax credits to invest, how much of that 150, you know, on net now over 5 years has to be first, how much has to be spent on treasury bonds, first of all, of that 150, you know, in general? 10 million? I mean, how, maybe your testifier knows the answer to that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name's Tony Toops. I'm with Advantage Capital Partners. I'm here from New Orleans to make myself available to the committee today to answer your questions. And yes, I mean, 100% of the certified capital, $187 million, has to be invested in startup companies that meet the statutory definitions in order for the fund managers, companies like ours who would apply to participate, to reap any profits. In the interim, they make, I think they can get a 1% management fee on the amount of capital they have under management. The industry standard is 2.5%. So they have to start making those investments and meeting the benchmarks under the statute in order to, for the investors to claim the credits and in order for the fund managers to participate even in those small management fees and then to ultimately participate in the profits. So 100%, $187.5 million under the bill has to be invested into the companies. There is a structure that in order to enable the insurance companies to participate, there is structure, and each company does it differently, of purchasing a certain amount of treasuries as a reserve to guarantee to the insurance company that it will be able to get its capital back. The insurance company, you know, because they're regulated and have to have cash available to pay claims when the time comes, they generally tend to make debt-type investments. The insurance company wants to view this as a debt investment, plain and simple. They can't go out and they won't invest in venture capital type investments on their own. So this is a vehicle so which they can do it. So yes, there is a purchase of treasuries. Each one's different. Each company does it differently. But so that the insurance company at the end of the day will be able to get back its principal, much like if they had bought a bond or a certificate of deposit.
Well, and maybe if someone can pass these handouts too, we can have them around. And I do want to hear from Senator Marty too, but can you answer, okay, of the 150, or in your case, because it's not a full credit, it's 187, just in general, and you said they'd all be different, what amount of that 170 is going to go into treasury bonds? I mean, I thought in reading, I don't remember if it was Colorado or Missouri or who, I mean, like half of it.
Sometimes, yes, it can be that high. But 100% of the certified capital does indeed have to be invested. So that's a reserve, and in fact, that is the venture capital manager's job, is to come
that's
in,
small.
Make
okay.
the make the investments, and to, in fact, then create the capital to pay back both the investors and to make the deploy the capital to the small businesses.
Okay, so I just want to understand, because if I don't have this right, I want to be corrected, and I do, you know, Senator Saltzman, tell me if I'm right. This is how I think of it. Okay, there's $150 million of tax credits paid for by the taxpayers. That's going off to the insurance companies, who are then passing it on to the promoters, the managers. And the managers have to take like half of that and just buy secured treasury bonds, first of all, to calm the insurance company. So right out of the chute, like half of the 150 is gone. Right? I mean, from the taxpayer's vantage point, how much is the taxpayer leveraging? So then their promoters get their 1% instead of 2.5% as opposed to other states, and they get startup costs, I believe, in the bill, as I read it. The startup costs are paid for. And so all that kind of stuff is shaved off. And then the remaining of the 150, let's say it's $60 million, that's what's used to go directly into these businesses that we're trying to grow. Is that correct?
Over the course, yes, that's correct. But over the course of the stream of the tax credits, the whole $187 million has to be invested in order for investors to get profits, for the fund managers to participate in profits, and for the program is how it's designed, and that's how it has worked in other states. And could I add one thing to
sure.
a statement that was made earlier? No jurisdiction has ever repealed a certified capital program. No jurisdiction is currently considering to do that. There is no legislation on the table. I was handed a handout earlier today before this hearing that has tremendously absolutely false information in it. And I'd be happy to provide data to correct the record on each and every of those points.
Okay, and you know, and that, you're right. I mean, that's how it works around here. You know, everyone kind of puts their arsenal out of, you know, this doesn't work or this does. And, you know, I get all that.
But I'm talking about factual data, man.
Yeah, so, but I, you know, I did read, and I could find it for you, that the chief author, which was the Speaker of the House in, I don't know if it was Missouri or Colorado, said, it was a quote, you know, I passed 80 great bills and one bad one, and this was the bad one, and they want to get rid of it. And I, you know, I mean, others, you know, can think this through. I mean, I, you know, I'm trying to be straight with you that I'm not a fan of these anyhow.
Sure.
But what I'm saying, if I were, you know, why would we want to have 50 of the 150 or 60 of the 150 going into these investments as opposed to 150 of the 150? I mean, to me, I don't like any of them, but I think, you know, this one seems a really inefficient, low return on the dollars. Senator Saltzman.
Right. Well, on those points, Madam Chair, I think it's important to note that while these dollars are being invested, they are growing jobs. And so when you talk about the return on investment, it's not just about the tax credit. It's what is happening in terms of job growth and people working, paying income taxes, and how are we leveraging dollars that are needed to make these companies grow, because we're not going to have these jobs here. I mean, I think we have a history where we are seeing a trend right now of where these companies are leaving our state, looking for other resources or not developing to the point where they can create the jobs that we have the potential for. The other thing that I'm going to go back to is that I know you can find quotes about this program that are very disturbing, but what has happened in the past and how this program has then learned from those mistakes, from those changes, and where it is today is very different. And I think that that's what, you know, we'd like to be able to address is some of the quotes, some of the examples of when the program was new versus what's happening now. And again, Wisconsin, and we can certainly, I don't have all the data today to pass out, but Wisconsin, the data that they have, and I think it's important to look at how where this information is coming from, because this is all recorded on public sites. But to go to Wisconsin and see the report that came out, I believe it was in fall of 2008, so it's fairly recent, the return and what they're seeing in terms of, again, how this leverages additional capital on top of this for companies and what that means in terms of job growth. Recently, there was an article that came out that talked about, you know, the big tech centers. It's Madison, Wisconsin. Because you've got a research facility, you've got a program, a comprehensive program like this, and then you've got the private sector. It's creating that environment, and you need all three. You also need the infrastructure that, you know, I think we've done in Minnesota, where you've got, you know, the airport, you've got the infrastructure, those kind of things. But we're falling behind other states. I went to a conference this last summer, and I was there, and Pennsylvania was there. And they said, we want to be the next medical device center. You know, Minnesota has been the medical device center. Their position, they're doing programs like this. So I think we go back to, we can look at data that I guess would question the program. Let's look at the most recent data. And as these jobs are emerging, as these ideas are coming forward, what are other states doing? And what can we learn from them?
Thank you. Senator Marty, your thoughts? You know, it's interesting, Senator Saltzman, that you mentioned Madison, because the angel investor promoters all claim that that's what made Madison, Madison. So I guess Cafco claims it too, so it's just sort of, it's hard to know who's causing a job creation. Senator Marty, you want to join it? Because could somebody?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the conference committee. Just being on this conference committee, except when I read in the paper.
Is that true?
Except when I read in the paper that the pace here was slower and slowest. but you do have good discussions and appreciate that. And appreciate the chance to talk about the CAPCO issue. And first I want to start off by saying I think Senator Bach said is right. I think we're all very concerned about economic development jobs, and this is a time when we're more concern than ever, but that's why we have to do things that make sense to do. And this business investment company credit of $150 million, it's, as some of you pointed out, it doesn't show up on the tracking sheets because it doesn't cost anything right now, but it does cost $150 million. And it's a very complex scheme. I don't pretend to understand it fully. I think your explanation was pretty good. A lot of this money is not going into venture capital. It's not fair to call this venture capital. In fact, the bill that came out of the Senate Jobs Committee and came to the Tax Committee allowed it to be used for retail. I mean, it's not really the high-risk type of investment that we want to talk about here. And they can say, oh, yeah, well, investment in retailers that do high-tech stuff. Well, I mean, that's retail. It's not a good venture capital investment. And venture capital is extremely valuable and extremely important. And we should start out by saying Minnesota as well. We're one of the top 10 states in venture capital consistently in per capita things, which means we do better than Wisconsin.
Madam Chair.
Please. Senator Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, as you know, we specifically added a line in here that prohibited retail sales.
Okay. Senator Marty, so Senator Saltzman, the retail was prohibited? And I should say, I the tape in the Senate isn't as good as the tape in the House, because I actually listened to Senator Saltzman's hearing to try to understand what was going on, and there was a discussion about retail. And I thought it was really interesting. I wish Senator Bach was here to hear me say this, that he made a speech about we shouldn't use public taxpayers' dollar for retail, and I'm going to remind him of that when we get to the Mall of America. But he very expressly did not want retail in there, and there was a discussion, but it was hard to hear. Senator Scheid talked about it as well, and then someone testified and said, well, maybe we should keep it because you never know, one of these things we might want to invest in might have a retail component, and they talked about a Best Buy thing in another state, which honestly I was a little concerned because I thought, why would Best Buy need this investment? But there was a long discussion, and it was at the end, and there was this, let's take retail out. So that was part of it, but there was a discussion about that. And I couldn't hear everything you said, Senator Saltzman. In fact, I asked people to transcribe it, and there's parts in the transcription that say, can't hear, or right in the middle of Senator Scheid. So I did really try to understand this, but now I want, you know, everybody to try to understand it because I, you know, obviously remain a skeptic. But, yes, there's no retail in the provision that's in the Senate tax bill right now. Senator Scott.
And Madam Chair, it's, you know, we've had lots of paper and lots of stuff going on, but it's good if we deal with what's actually in the bill.
Right. Yes, Madam Senator Marty, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Scott, just so you know, I was not trying to mislead. I actually said it came out of the Jobs Committee because the whole point is this has been revised based on the mistakes of the past. This is totally different. This has been well worked out. And I'm saying it came out of a Senate committee to the Tax Committee with retail in it. That's just to make my point that it's not venture capital in the way we think of venture capital, and that venture capital is really important. But this is a complex scheme that isn't adding to it. I think the Dr. Rubin, whose testimony you have had handed out, and I actually put another excerpts of it out there as well, she talks about how this actually hurts venture capital because the way these investments are made, it takes away from the local venture capital firms that are putting money out. And she said, she described it in a way that I think was pretty clear to me. And it fits very well with what they described when the Advantage Capital or whatever firm it was that just spoke a few minutes ago. They take the money, and as you said, they put some of it into bonds so that they get the return for the insurance companies. And the rest of it they put into the investments they choose. And they have to do all these criteria. When they cannot take any of the profits, as they said, until they take the $187 million and would invest that at some point. It may have to recycle the investments till they get there, but they can't take any of it back until then. But the way Dr. Rubin described it was, it's as if you take, the state says, we're going to go to our stockbroker and say, here's $150 million for you to invest. And we want you to invest it in Minnesota businesses. This criteria doesn't have a lot more than that. Doesn't say it has to be in northern Minnesota businesses or in small businesses or whatever. It basically tells them they have to invest in certain types of businesses in Minnesota, but not beyond that very precise. And then the stockbroker would take the state's money, invest the money, and at the end of 10 years, they get to keep the money. We don't do it that way. You get your money back when you invest your money. And Dr. Rubin suggests if we wanted to promote venture capital, we'd be a lot better off if we take the $150 million, put out an RFP to venture capital firms and say, here's $150 million. We want you to do it under these criteria. We want you to have to invest in Minnesota venture capital. It's exclusively Minnesota. You can put other criteria on it if you want to make it more specific. But we tell them, here's what we want. And then in the excerpts from the testimony that I handed out, the short one says, if Washington, D.C., where she was testifying recently, because Washington, D.C. put in $50 million into Capco, I think, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago. If they invested the $50 million in normal venture capital funds that earned a 20% internal rate of return, which I guess is fairly standard for what they get, they're high risk, but some of them pay off very big, the District of Columbia would receive on its $50 million investment $120 million back, $119.6 million back over, I think it's 10 years. However, if they give $50 million to the Capcos and they generated the same internal rate of return of 20%, District would receive back only $4.5 million out of their $50 million, while the Capcos would earn $132.5 million in profits. That's what I mean by effectively they are taking the money, giving it to the stockbroker, saying invest the money, at the end, you got to do it according to the companies we want you to. Then at the end of the 10 years, you get to keep the money. And that's not a good deal. And that's why I've found, I'm very skeptical of a lot of these business subsidies. But this one really struck me as particularly harmful. And the Capcos, as she testifies, and they may actually hamper the performance of venture capital in the state.
Okay, well, we've got Representative Loeffler waiting, then Senator Moore. So, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members. $150 million in this type of tough budget is a lot of money, and I think we're all worried about the job losses in Minnesota. And I'm quite honestly most concerned about job retention rather than job growth, because I think we have a lot more skills at that area. But I thought it was interesting, as I'm looking through the tabs of the material, there's $92,000 investment on average creates one job. And the average wage is $55,000. And the Minnesota projection that they've done on tab 6 says actually over half the jobs would be jobs retained. So even though we keep talking about creating new jobs and growing new businesses, it looks like less than half of the investment would actually result in new jobs. And that doesn't really jive with all the discussion about taking brand new startups and they're going to create new jobs that never existed before and new areas of science that haven't happened. And so I'm kind of confused, because all the discussion today has been about early startups, brand new ideas, new science, and it looks like over half of this is going to be jobs that already exist.
Yes, Senator Saltzman, please.
Well, some very good questions, Madam Chair, and I just want to note in all this that we're not doing shovel-ready jobs here. You're talking about emerging technologies that many times require additional research, and so it's not just about a job. It's about perhaps facilities or studies. One of the things that we've looked at, some of the programs that we have seen, is that when they need additional tests or some human trials or some of those things with some of our medical fields and those kind of areas, there is an additional cost to get them to that stage, and that's why capital is very critical to get them there. I think what's important to note is that with some of these quotes that have been used, that I can certainly provide testimony from people who followed this, who talked about the DC program and how the initial investment in terms of generating additional capital had a 6-to-1 ratio. That over the life of the program, that the district will actually realize $82 million in new tax revenue for that tax credit. And I think that when you talk about $150 million investment, we're not putting $150 million out there tomorrow. We're talking about a tax credit that goes into effect in 4 years, over 5 years. And I think what's important to note is that, though, but we need the $150 million out there right now in terms of job growth in terms of retaining jobs. I mean, if these companies are going somewhere else, we have an issue. So in terms of this is a big ticket item, but it's not that we are spending the dollars today. And while those tax credits are out there, we are growing jobs. It's not like we put these dollars in and we have nothing to show for it. That's, I think, what's important to like note here is that you always look at how much something costs. And I think we also have to look at what's on the other side if we don't do this. And I think those are the stories that, to me, really are a chill to me. Because when I look at Minnesota and how we are positioned right now in terms of our job growth, in terms of our unemployment, in terms of the changing demographics in our state, we have got to position ourselves to take advantage of every strength that we have. And we've always been a brain trust state. We are not necessarily a manufacturing state. We have wonderful resources, but we have been successful because of the ideas and things that have come out of this state with a Medtronic, a 3M, some of these other areas where we've seen incredible success. And that's what's at stake here. It's that we just can't be on cruise control and think that, you know, Medtronic as it is today is going to be our ticket to success. We've got to continue to generate new ideas, and then those ideas have to stay here. And that's what this is all about. It's putting a policy out there that says to these emerging companies, we want to help you, we want to be your partner in order to stay in Minnesota. People who have come and testified have talked about that their roots are here, their families are here, but in terms of where they want to take this idea that they have, they're feeling that we've turned our backs on them and that other people have made these investments as a state to invest in their companies. This is something that is different and new, but I think that when we look at how we're going to really position Minnesota for success, if we don't have some of these policies, and that's where you look at, you work with your research, you work with academia, you work with public policy, and then you work with your private sector. And this is something where I think the business community would say that these pots of money, and again, it really goes to the fact that we talk about the capital gap, the valley of death. When you're in technology, I went to the Life Science Alley this last, I believe, December. 1,200 people were there representing all of these emerging companies. For Life Science Alley, the angel investor credit and having access to capital was their number one priority.
So we have Senator Moore. Any other conferees and Senator Marty. And we're going to give Senator Saltzman the last word because we're getting notes that people want to go to dinner now because we're going to break after we finish this. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I was looking at these notes, and one statement that I have heard not just here, but I think when we were having testimony during the week where when we were the Senate Tax Committee was hearing all these really jobs-oriented, creative ideas, and that's that somehow these different ideas, and particularly this idea, would hurt the local venture capital industry. And I don't know Dr. Rubin. I don't know her work. I know she's way smarter than me. But I don't think that she her statement about how this kind of a program could hurt the local venture capital industry understands that we don't have, here in Minnesota, we don't have a local venture capital industry. We don't. And that's part of what is concerning, I think should be concerning, not only to those of us who are policymakers, but to our research institutes and I think to our business community, is that we don't have that local venture capital industry. And I don't know if this is, you know, the cure, but I think that bigger question ought to be asked. You know, is it government policy? Is it, you know, what is it that's impeding, what is it that's disincentivizing the state of Minnesota from growing a robust thriving local venture capital industry. I mean, we should be so lucky that we have one that would be threatened by projects or proposals like this, but we don't have one to be threatened by it. And I, for one, think that it's really important for us to ask those questions about why we don't have a thriving local venture capital industry, one. Two, I think that it is exciting to be in the tax committee the week that we heard all of these really innovative, bipartisan, exciting ideas, because I think that if we can't have these kind of discussions during a time when we're looking at such tremendous budget difficulties, I think it would be so disheartening to do the work here. If all we are restricted to is to stare at our toes and to somehow come up with ways to deliver us from the immediacy of our problems without the hope that at the same time we're also devising ways so that when we come out of these budget difficulties, we've put in place an infrastructure to really build a foundation to take our state to the next level, I think it would not be very fun. I think we wouldn't really be living up to our responsibility as policymakers to help shape and direct the future of our state if we restrict our workload to only thinking about the immediacy of the problems that we have without giving some thought to and encouraging the creative ideas from our members to say, yes, we may restrict it in our ability to spend money, but we also want to carve out of that an opportunity that signals not only to the public but among our members here that, but you know what, we're not going to be paralyzed by the enormity of our current situation. We're going to open a window to also looking at how we can use this crisis as an opportunity to really go in very creative directions to build a foundation to our state. And I think that these proposals, for me, outside of the mechanics of how they actually operate and what the outcomes are, far smarter people can help us do that analysis. But these projects really represent, for me, the creative ideas that I think when we bring it to the table for a debate sends a message to the public out there that we're actually able to function beyond being paralyzed by trying to find a way out of this budget situation, but we're actually opening up our minds to also think about the future of the state. And I think that's a really good direction to be moving in.
Thank you. And yes, I do want to say, though, I think just in case anyone in the true public is listening, just so folks aren't confused, this is not the angel investor credit. I mean, we've had a couple statements about that what we're talking about right now is not the angel investor credit. And I do think the mechanics really are important, as Senator Moi said, because if you're going to do these, which I admit I'm not one who believes in them, but I would think a bunch of people in the House actually do agree with them. But I would say the mechanics absolutely matter, and it shouldn't be left to others. It should be left to the tax committee. Because they are tax credits, they are tax programs, and we have to determine, do we want 30 cents on the dollar, 15 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar, 70 cents on the dollar, if we're going to do these. And to me, this seems at about, maybe 25 cents on the dollar. And I'd say the angel investor credit probably returns a lot higher. And I think if the tax committee is going to put tax credits forward, and my guess is that we are going to negotiate this with the governor in the end, because he's a big fan of these. We all need to know the mechanics in a very detailed way so that if we're going to use taxpayers' money for this, we're going to know exactly what the return is going to be, and it's going to be written really clearly. So I do think these details really matter because it's really people's money. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, yes, I think the angel investments, and frankly, if we took the money and invested in venture capital, that wouldn't be a bad idea, because I agree venture capital is helpful, and it is, as Senator Salzman said, long term. This fine gentleman from New Orleans who came here, I mean, he should say it's a good program. Again, I think any stockbroker, you say, I'm going to give you money, and you got to keep it. You got to invest it, but then you got to keep it. They ought to say it's a good deal. But again, Louisiana, I've got the quote here from the Louisiana Department of Economic Development. If you're going to set up something, look at what we did and do the exact opposite. I mean, that's a pretty clear quote from somebody who works in economic development in the state that's had the longest history, far and away the longest history with these CAPCOs. But the one thing I wanted to, before turning over to Mr. Cox and AFL-CIO, make sure you look at this sheet on venture capital investments in Wisconsin and Minnesota, since all our businesses are fleeing to Wisconsin, because that's where they can get venture capital. Wisconsin invested $50 million in Capcos in 1999. If you look at the venture capital invested in Wisconsin, as this chart does, from January 1st of 2001 to June 30th, 2007, most of the time since the Capcos were put in place, give them a year to get started, Wisconsin has had $2.3 billion in venture capital invested. Minnesota's had $6.9 billion, almost over three times as much per capita. Wisconsin's a slightly larger state, but if you figure it out per capita, we've had three times the venture capital. So, Senator Moore, we do have venture capital here. We're one of the top 10 states of it. And the fact that we're not doing as good as we'd like to be, don't turn to the states like Louisiana, which has virtually none. I mean, they've had this Capco thing for 15, 20 years now, and they have no venture capital. In other words, that's the point. This doesn't do anything for it. And so Wisconsin invested public money in this. They basically gave public money to the Capcos, but it doesn't generate the venture capital. That's my whole point. Just look at that chart. We got three times the venture capital, and we haven't put anything into this. They put a lot of money into this and got nothing for it.
Okay, and I want to say I did not see Mr. Cox there, and Senator Salzman, I'm going to permit him to speak just like a minute here because that's not what we're doing here. We're not having a full-blown hearing on this, and I don't think it's fair to Senator Salzman to sort of cue up everyone against her bill here. I thought a better approach, and I had contacted Senator Bach's office to ensure that Senator Salzman and the advocates of this bill could be here, and that's why they are here. And I contacted Senator Marty, who I understood listening to the testimony had the other view because these were senators who debated it and heard this bill, and we did not. So I don't want to start having a trail of testifiers now because that's really not fair to Senator Salzman. So if Mr. Cox wants to just briefly tell us his position, but I do want to give Senator Salzman the last word, and we're going to go to dinner, and we'll keep debating another day if we're going to do this or not. But Mr. Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Wayne Cox, Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice, whose members include the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And the Minnesota AFL-CIO sent you a letter today asking you not to include the provision for the Capco approach in the conference report. And the reason that they did that is because they took a hard look at the analysis that had been done by the professor from Rutgers in the testimony she gave last month, in which she reviewed how these programs have operated in a number of states. And let me just give you two or three examples from her report. She said that the state of Florida that had allocated $150 million to the program did an audit 9 years later, and they found that the net result of gain was 20 jobs. She quoted the head of the Office of Economic Development in Colorado, who administers the program and who told a legislative committee that, "I think this state would be hard-pressed to design a program that costs the taxpayers more and delivered less." And then she took a look at Missouri, where a state study there had found that 66% of the funds were not used for the intended purposes of providing capital for startup or expanding businesses. And then she quoted an audit from then-auditor in Missouri, Clara McCaskill, who concluded that the program was ineffective and should be allowed to expire. So there's ample evidence that in certain states, at least, this program has been found to be ineffective and a poor use of taxpayers' dollars for getting the results desired. And the reason she concluded that was that she thinks the incentives that the program sets up are sort of out of whack, where you don't have a lot of accountability for actual job growth, where the dollars can be, in effect, used in a way that isn't necessarily directed effectively for really high growth future growth industries. So she says that if you want to do angel type investment, there's better ways to do that than this particular device. So we would ask you to do, if you want to move forward on it, you ought to do some real due diligence as to whether or not this particular device is one that you would want to bank $150 million in the future.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Salzman, final word or final
pitch? Very briefly, Madam Chairman. Thank you so much. First of all, if you look on tab 9 of your booklet, there is a rebuttal to many of these comments regarding Louisiana. It has some of Dr. Rubin's quotes and then the actual data. Again, I think it's important to note that some of these programs have been around for 10 or more years, and what happened then and what's happening now is very important to note. So I hope you will take a look at that, because I think it does rebut many of these very inaccurate statements that I think we need to have the facts on the table. The other thing about Wisconsin, let's start looking at the trends. You know, maybe in the past, again, we are resting on our laurels in Minnesota. We just think everything's going just great here, and we need to be looking at what are the trends and what's happening with the companies in the last year, year and a half, and in terms of Wisconsin and what their policies have done. And just to close, in terms of angel investors versus venture capitalists, angel investors come and go. It's sort of, you know, it's a smaller program. Venture capitalists come in and invest and manage. So I think that to look at these programs, if we can look at some of those things, again, I'm not an expert, but I think if we listen to the people who are on the front line in terms of the companies that are growing and what they need, that has been my quest, is to talk to a number of folks who are sitting there who have promising ideas, what they've needed, and how they are looking to the state, you know, for leadership on this, and what's happening out there with other states. I would encourage you to do that. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for giving me
and
the opportunity
you,
to Salzman, be here
I
today.
I understand you were in another conference committee, so we really appreciate you being here. Senator Skoit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, as we listen to this and this debate and this discussion we're having today about these credits that we're bringing forward to help Minnesota, I didn't catch the name of the author of the book that you did refer to, but I did write down what you said, and I was a little surprised by this statement that if we keep government out of business, things will just go fine. And, you know, if we learned anything from this last year, I think we know that we can't just let the free market go. There has to be some guidance and some regulation. And this isn't regulation, but this is guidance. And I think there's a role for that. And we talked about the university and the great ideas and how, you know, somebody has to have that first business start from the great idea. And the university recognizes that they're not the ones to do that. But some of these folks are. And if we can help them a little bit along the way, I think it'll serve our state very well. And, you know, I think about this idea that, you know, we're just going to let all these people take these ideas and go start it up and the world will all be flat. You know, that might be true if we lived in a vacuum. And you know, when you're pure and true and in a vacuum, I get that. But we don't live in a vacuum. And people do have other initiatives and other stuff going on in this world. And I think for Minnesota to step up and continue to be competitive, you know, we need to be given some guidance and some direction to these companies. It's just the perfect idea. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. We'll discuss it. We'll debate it. But, I sure would be disappointed if when we're done this session, we haven't done something to help with these startup companies, because it's been what's made Minnesota Minnesota for a number of years now. And I think Senator Saltzman's right. I think we've kind of been living on our laurels. I think we haven't been investing as we should be, and sure hope we're able to do some of these Senate provisions that we brought forward.
I appreciate that. I do think we'll end up doing some, because two against one. I'm just trying to structure them from best deal to worst and trying to work through them. So I hear you there. And I should note, for all the passionate testimony about all the things that happened in Minnesota long ago, they weren't done with angel investor credits or mechanisms like this. So, I mean, for anybody who thought that that's how they were done, they weren't. So somehow it happened then without them. So we just need to keep that in mind so as we go forward. But I do think we're going to have some of these provisions, because the governor wants them and the Senate wants them. And I just think it's, you know, we just have to raise taxes higher to pay for them. That's the trade-off. And the way the Senate's doing is by raising taxes on businesses to pay for them.
And Madam Chair, I do appreciate that we are getting into the details of what's going on, because I think you're absolutely right. If we're going to do these things, we need to understand what they are, what the return is. You know, there's cost of money over time. Part of it plays into this. So You know, we have to understand all that stuff. And, you know, the true 1950s, 40s, 30s, 60s, whenever some of these companies started, it was a different world than we live in now, too. And, you know, we have to recognize that. And so, you know, yeah, looking forward to this discussion.
Appreciate that. We are going to recess for 45 minutes for dinner. 45 minutes. We'll see you at 7:20. We're in recess.